WCCO and Twin City Federal present Minnesota Milestones. Sight and Sound. The Story of Communications. Once there was an idea, and the idea spread from man to man. Some treated it with indifference, some fought for it, many died for it. And that idea was freedom, the freedom to write, to believe, to talk, to communicate, and exchange ideas with other men. This is the story of that freedom, and how it grew here in Minnesota. How it spread, sometimes haltingly, sometimes receiving discouraging setbacks. It is a story of progress, from the laborious clanking hand-pressed, roaring high-speed giant rotary, from clacking telegraph keys to electronic miracles, bringing the voices of history across continents, telephone, radio, television, all these giving power to man's voice, thundering around the world. WCCO presents the 11th in a series of 12 hour-long special broadcasts in honor of Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. This year-long series we call Minnesota Milestones. I'm E.W. Zebarth.
I am Cedric Adams.
And I am Bob DeHaven.
In this hour, you will hear how it all happened, how the communications marvel grew. It's the story of the country editor, the reporter on the beat, of wires that stretch thousands of miles to every remote corner, of radio's voice of service, television, and electronic wonders and miracles yet to come. This is a story of man talking to man, another in the series of Minnesota Milestones, Minnesota's Sight and Sound.
Day in the morning. What on earth is that?
Wait a minute. Let me turn it down so we can talk.
Never have I seen such a collection of wires and tubes and lights and panels. What is it anyway?
Oh, this. Oh, just a little gadget I put together evenings. This is a reverse delineating oscillating audio scope.
Oh, pardon me if I seem confused. A reverse what? And who are you?
Oh, pardon me, Mr. Adams. I should have introduced myself. I am the professor, and this is a reverse Oh, well, you wouldn't understand anyway, so I shall say it is a time machine, a radio time machine.
Oh, now, wait a minute. Listen, just a minute. I know this is the age of electronic miracles and all that, but if you're trying to make me believe that you've discovered a way to go backward in time...
That is precisely what I want you to believe, Mr. Adams.
Oh, sure, I'll believe it. You've invented a time machine. Okay, now show me how it works.
Very well. Please be seated. Right here.
You mean me sit there and sizzle like a broiled chicken in that contraption? Oh, no, you don't.
Now, Mr. Adams, there is nothing to fear. This machine does not really take you backward in time. It merely registers the photovoltaic image upon the cerebrum, creating an illusory perceptive response attenuated to microvolt potentials, which are carried to the electromagnetic impulses of the atmosphere. In other words, you will simply imagine you are going back into time.
Well, I think I got the last sentence, Professor. All right now. Okay, turn it on.
And we'll be hearing from you, Mr. Adams, as soon as you become accustomed to the radio time machine.
From the very first, man sought somehow to add power to his voice, to be heard over the rolling hills and through the dense forests. He used smoke signals and tom-toms. He used signal fires and sent runners through the woods. In Minnesota 100 years ago, settlers in Plymouth Township of Hennepin County, and this is written in the records, devised another system of communication. They were spurred by the need for self-protection, cooperation against the common dangers of the wilderness. And so it was decided that each night at sundown, every neighbor in turn would fire a shot. And if any neighbor failed to fire his signal in turn, that was the alarm. Men saddled their horses and galloped to the rescue, calling other neighbors to join them. And whether it was attacked by enemies, whether it was illness or accident, neighbor was ready to help neighbor, called by the signal gun. Almost as soon as the settlers came, the newspapers came too. Some settlers were printers, and they brought with them a sack of type and a hand press. And soon a crude newspaper was born. James Goodhue, the best known of pioneer Minnesota editors, set up shop under primitive conditions, which he described with amazing good humor.
We don't mean to find fault with the pigs, for it's all owing to their bringing up. But really, our equanimity is somewhat ruffled if our chair is not jostled by the movements of their hard backs under our loose floor.
Goodhue was a fearless man of high principle. He had to be fearless, considering the vituperative manner in which he wrote. It was in January 1851 that Goodhue wrote a scathing editorial against one Judge Cooper.
This is Cedric Adams on the Radio Time Machine, and this is a most amazing experience. Here it is, a cold January day back in Pioneer St. Paul. And yet I don't feel the cold, I don't feel anything. Except I'm living it, seeing it, history being made. There's been much talk here, people standing in little groups shaking their heads. They're all talking about the editorial which appeared in Goodhue's Pioneer yesterday. I've never read anything like it. Goodhue called Judge Cooper a sot, a brute, and a profligate vagabond. And I'm standing on the steps of the territorial capital. I'm told that Goodhue will be arriving here any moment. And, here comes James Goodhue now, the hard-punching editor of the St. Paul Pioneer. He's striding up the steps of the territorial capital. We hope to talk with Mr. Goodhue, but wait just a moment. A man has just grabbed him by the arm. They're quarreling, they're shaking their fists. Each man reaches into his pocket. They have guns in their hand. It's a duel. A duel right here on the steps of the territorial capital. Spectators are gathering around now. You, pardon me, sir. Do you know who that man is? The one holding the gun and talking so angrily to Editor Goodhue?
Why, yes, I can tell you. That's Joe Cooper, the judge's brother.
Well, thank you, sir. And now we're going to move in a little closer to see if we can pick up on the microphone what Judge Cooper and Goodhue are saying.
You've written your last slanderous editorial, Goodhue. I'll blow your brains out.
I didn't write slander, sir. It was the truth. You raise that pistol and you'll be the one with your brains blown out.
What are you doing? You know dueling is forbidden in this territory and on the steps of the Capitol, too. Now give me those guns. Give them to me.
And there is Goodhue handing his gun to the sheriff. He takes Cooper's gun now. It looks as though the fight is just about over. The sheriff is walking down the steps now, but Goodhue and Cooper are still talking. They don't appear ready to give up the fight.
No, sir, I will not apologize. I said Judge Cooper is a sot and a brute, and I meant it. I will not retract.
Goodhue, I'm going to kill you.
Boy. Cooper has a knife in his hand. Goodhue leaps aside. He's reaching in his waistband, and he has a pistol. Another pistol. Cooper slashes at Goodhue. I can see the tear on his coat. Oh, his... Goodhue fired. Goodhue has shot Cooper. He's staggering. Cooper is. He's clutching his side. He's falling. I can't see too clearly now. The crowd is pressing in all around. They're calling for a doctor. The fight is over this time.
Such was the temper of newspapering in those early days, the days of personal journalism. There's the story of a fighting woman editor who dared to stand up to the town bully. Jane G. Swisshelm was a fighter for women's rights, a battler against slavery. The place, St. Cloud. Her foe was the political boss of St. Cloud, General Sam Lowry, a fiery ex-Southerner. Jane Swisshelm came with her daughter from Pennsylvania settled in St. Cloud and became editor of the local paper, The Visitor. It was inevitable, of course, that Jane and the General should clash, and clash they did back in 1858. Jane published a scathing editorial in which she denounced the General for his pro-slavery views, and he decided to retaliate.
This is Cedric Adams. My, this radio time machine is really a wonderful thing. It's now 8 o'clock in the morning, and St. Cloud is seething with activity. We're standing in front of the newspaper office, or what used to be a newspaper office. The place is now a shambles. Here's what happened. During the night, a gang of men broke into Jane Swisshelm's office. They smashed her printing press, carried the pieces together with the type, and dumped them in the river. We have obtained a sample of the sentiment here in St. Cloud, and there can be little doubt how the citizens feel. Excuse me, just a moment. Here comes Mrs. Swisshelm now. Mrs. Swisshelm, just a few questions, please. This is a terrible blow you've suffered. What will you do?
Yes, it is a terrible blow. I never dreamed that one man's intolerance, that one man's disregard for our constitutional right to freedom of the press would permit him to stoop so low. The General, he's a filthy blackguard.
Well, what do you intend to do? Will you remain in St. Cloud?
Yes, I shall remain here, and I shall continue to fight this man.
Most of the citizens I've talked to seem to be on your side.
That's true, and without them I should be unable to carry on.
I hear there's going to be a mass meeting at the village hall tonight. Will you be there?
I've heard that also, and if what I hear is true, that the citizens intend to support me in my efforts to teach this rascal proper manners, then I most certainly will be there.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Swisshelm.
And the citizens of St. Cloud did rally at that meeting. Ugly words were exchanged, but the citizens did raise enough money to allow her to publish her paper again. But libel suits and other troubles at last forced her to suspend publication. She started another paper called The Democrat, and for years continued her crusade for freedom in St. Cloud. Jane Swisshelm, one of Minnesota's early day courageous editors.
By the start of the Civil War, there were 125 newspapers in Minnesota, most of them weeklies. Of course, there was not enough news, no possibility of instant transmission of news in those days. Editors simply waited until the papers came from the East and reprinted the big national and international news events of the day from them. And so it was that on November 27, 1860, the Hoka chief carried not much news, but instead this announcement.
We are without the Friday's mail, which is of great value to us in making up our news department. Until the river is sufficiently safe for crossing, there will be no regularity in mail matter.
But the early day editor was not at all disturbed by that. If the paper could not be printed this Friday, then next Friday would do just as well. And then there came an event, an important event. Few men recognized it, but the world of newspapering and communications would never be the same again. And we'll go into that part of our story, the story of another Minnesota milestone, in just a minute.
To think that I can imagine myself backward in time. Sure be interesting to imagine oneself forward in time. Predict the future. You know, there's a thought to conjure with. Predict the future. No more troubles because you could prepare for them. And yet, if you knew everything that was going to happen, it would sort of take the pleasure out of life, too, I think. I suppose the ideal solution is to be prepared generally for the future and yet not know what it holds. Have a good cushion of cash tucked away at Twin City Federal, for example, so that you're ready for good times or bad. All it takes is some steady saving. Twin City Federal's dividends help, too. Current rate, 3.5%, compounded quarterly. Professor, I really have to hand it to you. This machine, this time machine of yours, is the greatest little gadget I've ever seen. This is simply tremendous. Why, I was right where these events of history were happening. I saw them.
Yes, yes, you saw them, Mr. Adams. But you never left this chair.
This is unbelievable, amazing.
There is, Mr. Adams, one side effect of which I neglected to inform you. I hope you won't be disappointed.
Side effect? Now, look, Professor.
Mr. Adams, there's no need for alarm. I merely neglected to mention the reverse delin... that is, the time machine also causes one to lose weight.
Lose weight? Well, this machine is even greater than I thought. Professor, I'm going right back in that chair this minute. Turn on the juice, old boy. I'm ready. And say, Professor.
Yes, Mr. Adams?
You better get DeHaven in here, too, will you? Old blubber boy could stand to lose a few pounds, too.
It's the 30th of August, 1860, and a group of businessmen from St. Anthony and St. Paul are gathered here in St. Paul. We want to talk now with Judge Aaron Goodrich, one of the prime movers in this campaign to bring the first telegraph line into Minnesota. Judge, this is an historic occasion here in St. Paul, isn't it?
Yes, sir. This will go down in history as a milestone of progress in Minnesota. The day when our great state ceased to depend solely upon the steamboat and the horse for communication. Now we shall be in instant contact with the whole civilized world.
Well, this has meant a good deal of effort on your part, hasn't it, Judge?
Well, effort, yes, but not my effort alone. All these gentlemen have played an important role in bringing this telegraph line here today. Our communities have themselves raised the funds for this project.
Thank you very much, Judge Goodrich. The judge has sent a message to Governor Seward of New York at the other end of this wire, 1,500 miles away. If Governor Seward received it, we should be getting an answer any moment now. Yes, here it comes, back over these many miles of wire. Here is the reply from Governor Seward of New York. The operator is writing down the message as it's being transmitted. And I'm going to take our microphone to Judge Goodrich. Will you please read the message for us as it comes in, Judge?
You have grappled New York. Now lay hold on San Francisco.
And from that day in 1860, the telegraph spread across Minnesota all through the 1800s. It followed the railroads, ribbons of steel across the prairies. And the singing wires branched to the smallest towns, bringing nearly instant contact with the big cities of the East. And the telegraph and the railroads caused an ever-widening gulf in newspapering. The daily newspapers in the big cities reached out even farther with the big news, the news of wars in Europe, news from New York and from Washington. While the weeklies in the small towns, there in the 1800s, turned away from news of national and international affairs and became journals of information and service to the local community and to the immediate county. One of the key advertising features in newspapers back in the early days was the patent medicine ads. A reader turning the pages of the Sauk Center Herald of May 14, 1880, would have found himself reading,
Halliday's Blood Purifier. Salicylica, immediate relief warranted. Permanent cure guaranteed. Now exclusively used by celebrated physicians of Europe and America.
The great cause of human misery. Just published in a sealed envelope. Price, 6 cents.
At times, patent medicine advertising was disguised as local editorial material. For instance, in the Sauk Center Herald of February 3rd, 1870,
the editor endorses Dr. Roback's pills and bitters and recommends Sheridan's cavalry condition powders for horses and advises the use of Johnson's anodyne liniment for the ears.
This practice of personal endorsement by the editor came to be frowned upon in time. Publishing standards were raised by the banding together of the editors into a single organization, the Minnesota Editorial Association, an association dedicated to advancing the professional ethics of newspapering.
This is Cedric Adams. I'm speaking to you now from the Merchants Hotel in St. Paul. This is the 20th of February, 1867. 25 newspaper editors are gathered here tonight
And as you can hear, they're having a mighty good time. But they're talking seriously, too. For this meeting is not only to get acquainted, but it's also for the purpose of organizing an association of editors and publishers. The assembled editors have just enjoyed a banquet sponsored by the citizens of St. Paul. There's been a round of toasts, and here's another now. H.H. Conwell of the Minneapolis Chronicle is rising to his feet. Let's pick this up on our radio time machine microphone.
Friends and fellow editors, I propose a toast. A toast to the press of our capital city. May its enterprise, zeal, and hospitality be amply rewarded by a rise in the state of advertising, extension of circulation, and 1,000 editorial suppers.
And the editors elected Daniel Sinclair of the Winona Republican as the organization's first president. The editorial association proceeded at once to improve the lot of Minnesota's newspapers to seek legislation in the public interest. And the editorial association continued to grow and to gain strength.
This is Cedric Adams again on the Radio Time Machine. It's 1871 and the MEA is celebrating its fourth birthday. The speaker at the convention tonight is J.A. Leonard of the Rochester Post. We have our radio time machine microphone on the rostrum. So now to editor J.A. Leonard of the Rochester Post.
There has grown up somehow in the popular mind an opinion, not actually believed, that he whose living is to be made by furnishing the people with a paper engages in a business having about it no business principles. That he is a happy-go-lucky lounger and toiler by turns, with no higher aim than to be acknowledged as sort of a semi-respectable pauper to whom pay is charity and support is patronage. Well, the editor is thought of as a modern Daniel, condemned to see all the lions without ever paying a cent. In person, a ragged, ink-daubed, unmannerly slouch, whose earthly ambition is to sometime get a whole suit at once of new clothes, to be paid by puffing, and whose greatest intellectual efforts culminate in bandying dirty personalities with some equally contemptible blackguard. Yeah!
It was at the Minnesota Editorial Association Convention of 1884 that President Herber made a suggestion. He called for a nationwide organization of editors and publishers, and the result was the National Editors and Publishers Association, later renamed the National Editorial Association. So to a Minnesota editor goes the credit for first proposing an organization to knit the country's small dailies and weeklies together. But newspapers came and went with astonishing rapidity back in the early days. They blossomed like wildflowers and faded almost as quickly, but some survived. The Minneapolis Journal was launched in 1858, shortly after, merged with the Weekly Chronicle, and finally appeared under a new name on May 25th, 1867. And the name? The Minneapolis Tribune, a name which has survived to this day. The Evening Journal was first published in November 26th, 1878. The journal might never have survived but for a most fortunate incident. A fad in the nation in those days was the foot race.
This is Cedric Adams again. I'm back here in the year 1879. This is foot race day here in the Twin Cities. A huge crowd has lined a 26-mile course through the streets and the country lanes in and about these cities. Each newspaper has entered one of its leg men in this race, and here is the list of runners. J.N. Nine for the Tribune, Ed Bromley for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, Ernest Sturtevant for the St. Paul Globe, Fred Pueller for the Hotel Gazette, and E.J.C. Atterbury for the Journal. We're standing at the finish line here on Hennepin Avenue at Bridge Square in Minneapolis. The runners have been out for nearly 4 hours, and the first man is expected here at the finish line shortly. I believe, yes, way up Hennepin Avenue there is shouting. Let's listen. Yes, one of the leg men is coming home. I can see him now. A small figure way up Hennepin Avenue, jogging along.
The crowd lining the streets is cheering and waving. The winner, I can't make out who he is waving back, and he's trotting along. He's not hard-pressed at all. I can see no one behind him. He's coming closer. I still can't make out his face. Dark hair. Yes, he has dark hair, and I think it's Atterbury in the Journal. He's running a little harder now. I see a second man following, about 2 blocks behind him. And as he comes closer, nearer the finish line, yes, it is Atterbury. Atterbury of the Journal. Stand behind me are all the newspaper publishers. I'm working my way through the crowd now, trying to reach the publisher of the Journal. We're almost there. You are happy, sir, are you not, that Atterbury won?
Happy? I'll say I'm happy. It means we stay in business. I'll say I'm happy.
You mean to say that you staked everything on this foot race? A race by amateur?
We sure did. We bet it all. The building, the presses, the horses, the wagons, and everything we own.
Suppose you'd lost.
If we had lost, then there wouldn't be a Journal on the street tomorrow night.
And that's the story of the foot race that saved the Journal. Its owners bought a new press with their winnings, and 6 years later, they sold the successful Minneapolis Journal for $130,000.
Professor, will you turn off your radio time machine, please?
Yes, yes.
Hey, what did you bring me back for? I was having fun.
Cedric, I think I'll complain to the management.
You will? Well, now, what's troubling you, my lad?
Seems to me you have the choice assignment here. Roaming around on the radio time machine, free as a breeze, popping in any old place and in any old year. It's not fair.
Oh, is that all? Well, we'll fix that, Professor.
Yes, Mr. Adams.
Blubber Boy DeHaven would like to try out your time machine. Do you think you can squeeze him into that chair?
Oh, I'm sure of it, Mr. Adams. Will you come this way, Mr. DeHaven? Oh, careful of that photovoltaic cell. That's right. My, he is a big one, isn't he?
All right, you can cut the comedy now.
Oh, but Mr. DeHaven, I never joke. I'm not a comedian.
Now, that's what you think. All right, now what?
Well, your project will be to talk to the man who set up the first working telephone in Minneapolis.
Okay, what's his number?
Quit clowning now. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
While we're waiting for DeHaven to find his man, let's talk about a way to reduce worry. One sure way to take the willies and the worries out of life is to own a nice, plump sum of money in a good, safe place. In other words, put some dollars away regularly at Twin City Federal, where accounts are insured for safety by a permanent agency of Uncle Sam's government. Helping to cut down your worry quota, too, you always earn liberal dividends saving at Twin City Federal. Currently, the rate is 3.5%, and it's compounded quarterly, added to accounts 4 times a year. So if you'd like to take the worries out of your life, put savings in. Remember, Confucius say, the heavier the pocketbook, the lighter the heart. Stop in. Start saving at Twin City Federal. Look for the twin clock, flashing the time and the temperature in downtown St. Paul and Minneapolis. Plenty of free parking for you right at the door, too.
You're listening to Minnesota Milestones, presentation of Sight and Sound, the story of communication, coming to you from your centennial station in St. Paul and Minneapolis, WCCO.
The telephone. People had heard of it back in the 1870s. And at the Great Centennial Exposition of 1876, it was the most talked about exhibit of them all. A miracle. Voices actually coming over a wire. Richard Henry Hankinson worked for one of the telegraph companies in Minneapolis. He was very much interested in the telephone, so in 1877, a friend sent him 2 crude instruments.
This is Bob DeHaven on the radio time machine. Dick Hankinson has an office here in the City Hall. Now, this is the old City Hall, the one that used to be located in Gateway Park. Dick, was it much trouble hooking up your two telephones?
No, not really. My home is just two blocks away. And here, you see, is one telephone. The other's located in a closet in my home. I use 2,000 feet of copper wire to connect the two phones, and, well, here's the battery.
What's your wife think about all this?
She doesn't have the faintest idea what this is all about. Why, I could be planning a trip to the moon for all she knows.
Are the phones all ready to go?
Yes, I believe they are. I tested them last night, and I'm going to give my wife a surprise.
Surprise? What do you mean by that?
I told you that I had the other phone in a closet at home. Well, I'm going to shout into this phone, and my voice will come out of the closet. And will my wife be surprised?
Well, all right, Dick. You go right ahead.
Mary, I want you to get up out of the chair now. Will you please go to the kitchen and fix my supper? Mary, are you listening?
Richard? Are you home? Richard, where are you?
I'm right here, of course. Can't you see me?
No, Richard, I can't see you. All I can see are the wires in this closet. Oh, Richard, I knew it would come to no good end. Richard, you're a ghost. Oh, Richard.
And that is the story of Richard Henry Hankinson and the first telephone system in Minneapolis. Hankinson expanded his system. He built a switchboard using parts of an old sewing machine. He started a company providing service for 11 subscribers. Telephone service expanded rapidly after that, and within a few years, nearly every community in Minnesota had one or two, sometimes as many as 12, telephone systems. By 1885, Minneapolis had 775 telephones. St. Paul had more than 700, with 300 miles of wire strung along its streets. In 1897, the first toll line was extended from Minneapolis to Chicago. Thousands of small, rural phone lines were established, the wire stretching from tree to tree in forest areas and along the barbed wire strand of fences out in the prairies. And the telephone was anything but a satisfactory instrument back in the 1890s and early 1900s, and that was especially true in the rural areas, and especially true in electrical storms. The situation happened all too frequently at first.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Oh, dad blame it. Hello? Can't you talk louder? I said, can't you talk louder?
No, I can't hear you.
Ah, this stupid consigned contraption. Tain't worth a powder to blow it up.
But telephone lines were spreading across the land. At about the same time, another new development, one of great importance to people living on farms. In 1896, due chiefly to the urging of the National Grange, the federal government established rural free delivery. The first service was established in West Virginia, and slowly it spread across the land until by 1917, all rural America was served by this vital link, the link that began to break down the farmer's isolation, established contact with the whole world. RFD was the first big step since the stagecoach hauled the mail west from the river towns where it had been brought by steamboat. A blessing to rural people everywhere. It made possible the purchase of goods by mail from the city, led to the growth of the mail order houses there in the early 1900s. And that was a time when no one dreamed that more than 6 tons of mail would leave and arrive by air in Minnesota every day. We're hours away from the farthest city, an important chapter in Minnesota's communication story.
A.C. Townley was the founder of the Nonpartisan League, a third party on Minnesota's political scene. In 1920, Townley established the Minneapolis Star, published 6 evenings a week, as the key organ of the league. He established the Northwest News Association, the first cooperative news-gathering organization in Minnesota, and used it to link together a string of nonpartisan league newspapers in Minnesota and in North Dakota. But Townley's once powerful league was fading fast back in the 1920s, and from 1924 to 1935, the Minneapolis Star was published by John Thompson, former executive editor of the New York Times. And then in 1935, the beginning of a big change in the old order in Minneapolis.
In 1935, John Coles of Des Moines and his brother Gardner surveyed several communities and finally selected Minneapolis as the market with the best possibilities for the development and growth of a new publishing enterprise. They purchased the Star from editor John Thompson and his associates, and in 1939, they acquired control of the journal. Star circulation had grown by that time from 80,000 to 135,000, about equal to the daily journal circulation. Just 2 years later, the Coles brothers completed their program for consolidation by acquiring control of the Tribune. They brought out the evening Star Journal and the morning Tribune from one publishing headquarters, but continued for a time to publish the evening Tribune from the old Tribune plant under the masthead of the Minneapolis Times. In 1947, that publication was dropped, and the name Journal was dropped from the masthead of the Star Journal. Many readers to this day continue to refer to the Minneapolis evening newspaper as the Star Journal, 10 years after the change.
All right, Professor, you can shut the radio time machine off now. Let's see how old man DeHaven enjoyed his trip.
Very well, Mr. Adams.
Say, that's an amazing thing. Simply amazing. Why, I feel as though I've been away 100 years.
You have, almost. I just told the professor to stop this miracle gadget of his. The next ride is mine.
Hey, wait a minute. I just had one short trip.
Oh, no, sorry, old man. No arguments. I'm getting back in there. This is a fascinating story that we'll be telling. The story of radio. And I want to be there to live it all over again for myself.
Well, okay, Cedric. You've been on WCCO longer than I have. If you want to pull rank like that, go ahead. It came back there in the 1900s, a faltering voice at first, but it was a voice, the fulfillment of man's dream. A dream that one day his voice would reach across the prairies, penetrate to the very depths of the forest, over mountains and seas to other lands and other continents. Marconi, DeForest, made it possible. A new communication, the wireless. But man was still not satisfied with that because it still was not his voice. It was merely a system of bleeps and noises and squeaks, not a true voice. There were no professionals in radio back in the early 1900s. There were amateurs, tinkerers, discoverers exploring the unknown. And they sat with the earphones clamped on their heads, bent over the cat's whisker, straining for the voices that came from afar. Feeble voices in those days.
This is Cedric Adams in the Radio Time Machine. I'm in Minneapolis now, and the year is 1914. We have with us a young man named Jim Coles. He's the first Minnesotan to hold a radio telephone license. Jim, I understand you're about ready to do something few people have done so far in Minnesota, and that is broadcast your own signal on the air.
Well, I sure hope to, Cedric, if this thing will work.
What type of transmitter would you call that? It's certainly a crude-looking gadget.
Crude? Why, this is the latest thing, Cedric.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to insult you, Jim. Are you all ready for the test?
Oh, I'm ready. And what I'll do is play this record on my phonograph and pick it up on this microphone. And here we go. I can hear it on the headset. Here, listen. It worked. My transmitter worked.
Thank you.
And that was one of the very first radio broadcasts to come from anywhere in Minnesota. A broadcast of Poet and Peasant Overture on a little homemade transmitter back in 1914. It was in 1920 that commercial organizations moved into the radio broadcasting business. KDKA, Pittsburgh, WEAF, New York, and WWJ, Detroit were among the first stations to take to the air. Jim Coles was active in this movement, too. And we'll look into this in just a moment.
Say, I wonder if this thing can go ahead in time, beyond 1958. Maybe I could take in a football game or two. And boy, wouldn't I flabbergast old DeHaven if I predicted every Minnesota football score for the entire season. I could even bet him who'd play in the Rose Bowl. By the way, that reminds me, whoever plays, it certainly would be thrilling to be at the Rose Bowl game, wouldn't it? Well, the next time you stop in at Twin City Federal, be sure to register for the big Rose Bowl drawing. That's the first prize, a trip for two, mind you, to Pasadena, New Year's Day with all expenses paid. And all you have to do to win is sign an entry blank and be a little lucky, of course, too. Remember, Rose Bowl drawing, Twin City Federal. Better stop in this week.
It's 1922 now, and there's a real rush here in the Twin Cities. It seems that everybody wants to put a radio station on the air. All three of the major newspapers, the Journal and the Tribune in Minneapolis and the Pioneer Press in St. Paul, all are starting radio stations. Jim Cole is working with the Journal station. Jim, tell us about the broadcasting setup you have. Where is your antenna located?
Well, we have a wire strung between two of the towers of the Minneapolis City Hall, Cedric. And we have our transmitting equipment located on the sixth floor of the courthouse tower.
Well, I'd say that's a very fine location. How did you manage that?
Well, it was easy, actually. We brought the mayor in as a member of our broadcasting company.
And this is WAAL, one of the first radio stations on the air commercially anywhere in Minnesota.
But those three newspaper-sponsored radio stations were not on the air long. The owners found what a huge cost was involved in simply maintaining a radio station. And in 1923, the three newspapers joined forces with six merchants in Minneapolis and opened a brand new radio station in the Oak Grove Hotel, WLAG, the immediate ancestor of WCCO. This was still early day radio, and there were long periods of silence. A broadcast and then silence.
Here are the closing Minneapolis grain futures. December wheat, 138 and one quarter. December oats, 44 and 5/8. December rye, $1.12. Number 2 corn, 107 and one quarter. Number 3 corn, 106 and one quarter. We leave the air now until the next market report in 2 or 3 hours. This is WLAG, your Call of the North station in St. Paul and Minneapolis. Please stand by.
Nobody seemed to mind the long periods of silence at first, but as the number of crystal radio sets increased, there was grumbling on the part of the radio audience. It wanted more. Musicians and entertainers were added to the daily schedule. But the owners of WLAG found it was still too costly to keep a radio station on the air back in the early 1920s. So they quit broadcasting in July of 1924. To the utter amazement of the business community, the uproar of protest was deafening. The farmers and the grain men wanted those market reports, and all the radio listeners wanted the music, the entertainment. So on the 2nd of October, 1924, the station returned to the air, renamed WCCO, after its new owner, the Washburn Crosby Company, forerunner of present General Mills.
This is Cedric Adams in the Radio Time Machine. The date, March 4th, 1925. One of the gala nights in the history of radio broadcasting in Minnesota. This is the opening night. The opening night for WCCO's brand new studios in Hotel Nicollet. And a double cause for celebration. The opening also of WCCO's new transmitter at Anoka. Everybody is here. The mayor, the alderman, the governor. Everybody inspecting the new studios. The last word in radio this year of 1925. There's a full orchestra here in the WCCO studios tonight. All the stars, George Osborne and Selma Erickson and Eddie Dunstetter and many, many more. And there is announcer Al Chance before the microphone. And the program is about
Good evening,
to begin.
Ladies and gentlemen. This is the gold medal radio station, WCCO St. Paul, Minneapolis, broadcasting a program from the new Nicollet Hotel, Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Northwest is very proud of its numerous fine orchestras. This evening, we present to you one of these with which you are all familiar. George Osborne's original Nicollet Hotel Orchestra. Mr. Osborne will conduct the orchestra in a performance of the famous prelude in C sharp minor by Serge Rachmaninoff.
Those were the days of radio's mushroom growth. Radios, the old Atwater Kent, the rectangular box with a horn on top, blossomed in every home, in the city, out on the farm. And radio brought relief from those lonely hours. It brought music, entertainment, and it brought the markets and news and weather. And there were some radio stations which tried a different approach, using the bizarre and the spectacular, seeking to shock rather than serve. One such effort was the Break the Chains campaign of the 1920s.
Now, I want you folks to hear this. I want you to pay very close attention. Our investigators purchased a pound of butter at one of the chains today. Just an ordinary, everyday pound of butter. A pound of butter such as you might have bought. In fact, maybe you did buy one just like it. We bought that pound of butter and brought it here and weighed it on our own scales. How many ounces are there in 1 pound? How many? Well, in this pound of butter, there were only 12 ounces. Not 16 ounces, 12 ounces. And that, my friends, that is the kind of short weight, short change, short practice you receive every day at the chains.
That was the Break the Chains campaign of Dr. George Young, Ernest S. Carey, and John Woodward. Sugar John Woodward. But no matter how, no matter by what means, radio was growing, growing so fast the number of stations tumbled all over one another on the dial. Clearly, some regulation was necessary. And so the federal government set up a commission to regulate how loud and how far these new, powerful voices of radio were to carry, but not to control what was broadcast. And then, in 1932, a significant step was taken. The Federal Communications Commission allocated 24 clear channels, places on the broadcast band of frequencies on which a station could transmit virtually free of interference from other stations. And one of those channels, now 830 on the dial, was allocated to Minnesota. And here at last was the culmination of one of man's dreams, the powerful voice that could instantly reach across the plains, penetrate into the deepest forest, span rivers and mountains and seas. The voice that could reach uninterrupted for hundreds and hundreds of miles. And the final chapter in that story still remains to be written. Superpower. The FCC is considering reducing to 12 the number of clear channel radio stations and giving those 12 power enough to span the entire country, to be heard rain or shine, day or night, without interference. Power enough to become national radio stations.
Until recently, all commercial broadcasting used a system known as amplitude modulation, or AM. But since the late 1930s, some stations in Minnesota have regular broadcast frequency modulation, commonly known as FM. This development has led to the experimental broadcasting of stereophonic sound, generally using both AM and FM systems. Many sounds are broadcast that your standard radios cannot hear. The air is continually filled with sound traveling at the speed of light, radio waves. Amateur radio operators, hams, have contributed much to the broadcasting industry. Many amateur operators spend countless hours at their rigs, talking to their fellow hams around the world, sometimes just to exchange technical information on the construction of receivers or transmitters, other times forming a link vital to national defense and human life. The state of Minnesota recognizes the importance of amateur radio operators by assigning them special automobile license plates. The federal government uses radio to tell the story of America to the world. The story of Minnesota, as told on Minnesota Milestones, is being broadcast by the Voice of America. Growing up and growing larger along with radio during the 30s and on into the 40s were other forms of communication. It was back in 1921 the Northwestern Bell Telephone Company was organized, taking over the old Northwest Telephone Exchange Company and the Tri-State Telephone and Telegraph Company. And it grew until in 1958, Northwestern Bell operates 960,000 telephones in the state of Minnesota. The independent telephone companies in the state account for 240,000 telephones more. And that sound, listen, the clacking, the clattering, that is a Northwestern Bell Telephone Company long-distance dialing machine. It is handling automatically, unaided, 25,000 long-distance calls every day. And this, a miracle of communications today in 1958.
Western Union, too, has progressed a long way from those days back in 1860 when the very first telegraph line connected St. Paul with the faraway East. Today, Western Union has a high-speed communication center in Minneapolis, a $2 million center that features an electric brain which automatically flashes messages between all points in the state. Another communications miracle.
And there's radio's younger cousin, television. The first television station in Minnesota, KSTP, went on the air April 27th, 1948. 1 year and 4 months later, on July 1st, 1949, a second television station began broadcasting for viewers, and that station became WCCO-TV. Both radio and TV are finding their place, working together side by side, each performing a different function.
In an emergency, local or national, it is radio to which people turn for fast, accurate, and complete reports. And radio is personal, too, providing something of interest and importance to every member of the family, every family. From the early morning disc jockey who starts the day with a song and a smile, to the quiet music that accompanies the night, radio is a constant servant, a modern Aladdin's lamp. The flick of the switch brings the latest market reports or the newest hit song, a well-loved symphony or a funny story, play-by-play of an exciting sports event, or a thoughtful analysis of important news. And wherever you go, there's radio. In the barn and the car, in the kitchen and the supermarket, on the beach and in the woods, in the bedroom, basement. Truly, radio is everywhere. And television, adding the dimension of sight to entertainment in the house for those who have time to watch. Records and movies are not usually thought of as means of communication, and yet no better way has been devised for presenting the past to the present and the present to the future. And what of the future? Well, for that, we have one place to which we can turn. Cedric Adams in the Radio Time Machine.
For a look into the future, I have brought the professor with me. Professor, what do you see?
Mr. Adams, I see satellites in fixed position rotating with the Earth, forever remaining over the same spot. And from them are coming the radio signals, the sounds of the future.
Amazing, Professor, amazing.
Precisely, Mr. Adams. And I see individual radio receivers will be so plentiful and reasonably priced that every man will carry one in his pocket. Every woman will carry one in her purse, providing instant communication with the whole world.
Say, Professor, I just noticed that wristwatch you're wearing. It has no dial. No hands. How do you tell time?
That, Mr. Adams, is not a wristwatch. That is a highly portable radio television telephone.
Now, wait. Do you mean to tell me that it's all of those things all in that tiny, tiny space?
Absolutely, Mr. Adams. Here, allow me to give you a demonstration. It is now about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I desire to contact my home. I set the dial so to XCV45216. And then I press this button, so. And now, The radio television telephone is ringing in my home. Now, watch here, and you will see my wife as she answers.
Hello? Oh, it's you, dear. When will you be coming home?
I shall depart at exactly 4:55, and you may expect me to alight from the copter jet bus at precisely 5:23.
Oh, that'll be fine, dear. And, Poopsie?
Yes?
Would you mind terribly stopping at the market and bringing home 10 pounds of lamb chops? You know, the infra-cooked kind. Our supply is terribly low.
That, Mr. Adams, is one thing that hasn't changed in our world of tomorrow.
What did you say, dear?
Oh, I said, never mind. I was talking to an old-fashioned friend of mine. Yes, I shall bring home the lamb chops. Goodbye. See you in 1 hour and 18 minutes.
Goodbye, dear.
Say, Professor, you know, something is dawning on me. I think I understand something. You just called me an old-fashioned friend. And you mentioned something about our world of tomorrow. You seem so familiar with this world of the future, so sure of yourself.
And what do you suspect, Mr. Adams?
Why, I'm sure that I know I never saw you around before.
Precisely, Mr. Adams.
This we know in our Minnesota centennial year, 1958. We know of the developments in communication, newspaper, telegraphy, telephone, wireless, radio and television, magazines, delivered mail. Many still living can remember a world without these miracles. We know that further electronic and nuclear marvels lie ahead, undiscovered, as yet undreamed, bringing changes greater than those of the past century. Through communication, the world will shrink again. Man talking to man, his voice able to reach around the earth and beyond. And though man's voice be louder now, though it can thunder to any corner of the earth, what of man's mind? Will men's minds be able to reach out far enough to comprehend intelligently? Will men learn to understand each other? Will man be able to match the miraculous machines which he is creating in the wondrous world of communications? Upon the answers depend what sight and sound will greet the Minnesota man in the next 100 years.